Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Ayin Bet Amud Aleph, but the two dots. Gemara here is continuing to discuss certain nidarim that he takes that are untenable, and therefore she has a right to sue for divorce and then get her ketubah in these instances. The last thing we left off was when he cuts off her social interactions, whether that is on the positive side in terms of attending smachot, or it's on the side of attending avelut or consoling those that have had losses. Again, we discussed yesterday the idea that if he cuts her off from these things, that will leave her bereft of any comforters or a future where others will do the same for her. Then, mishum davar acher ashai. On the other hand, if he does insist that she does not attend these places because of a davar acher, then it's okay. My davar acher. What is this davar acher? Am Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel mishum bnei adam prutzim shemitzuyim sham. There is promiscuity that is taking place in these places. They are inappropriate places for her to go. Then if he takes the neder, because it's not just a stam neder to lock her in the house or prevent her from having these social interactions, there's a particular problem that he's trying to prevent, or he's trying to stop here. And in that case, it's fine. Amravashi lo amran eladit chazik. That's only if we know for certain, or there's a good probability that this will be the case. He can't just speculate about the fact that, oh, I don't want you going out because there could be promiscuity in these places, but rather it's got to be a case where he knows for certain that the type of people or the location is somewhere where these problems do exist, and therefore he's preventing her from going there. It can't be an excuse that he's using to prevent her in general from attending weddings. It's got to be that there's a real particular issue in this location or at this simcha. V'imamarla Amanat Shite Amri. If he says to her, yeah, I want you to say certain things, when he takes a neder that will make her asur b'hana, unless she acts in a certain way or speaks to other people about these things, v'teima, let her just say it. Why does she have to trigger the neder? Why does she have to get a divorce? He's telling her, go speak to these other people and say this to them. Just let her say it and be done. So I'm Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, dvarim shel klon. It's a case where these are embarrassing matters. Now, whether that means embarrassing matters because they are matters of intimacy, things that were spoken about in their intimate moments, and he's having her disclose them to other people, so that might be the possibility, or he's asking her to speak about private matters, which are not matters of public interest, and therefore, if she goes and speaks about them, she will be embarrassed by that fact. So either of those are sufficient grounds for her to sue for divorce, because she doesn't have to act in a manner that will make her embarrassed or make her a social outcast. And therefore, if that's what he's demanding from her, she does not have to abide by that neder. Oh, shetei memal'ah u'me'ara le'ashpa. She'll fill up things and dump them into the garbage. V'tiaved. Again, the Gemara asks the same question. Just let her do it. What's the big deal? If this is what she has to do, let her do it. And then the neder will not be chal. I'm Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel. She'memal'ah v'nofetzet. The case where she fills up and then scatters it out. Rashi over here talks about it being a euphemism for the fact that he insists after they have intimate relations that she gets up and runs around so that the shechvat zera will not be kolet, that she will not conceive. And it's basically a rudimentary type of birth control, but he's insisting that she does this so she will not become pregnant. So that is unacceptable because it's just not normal behavior. It's not something that we would expect to him to insist the woman does. But Nita Tana, Shitimale Asaraka de Maim, Vitara le Ashpa. She'll fill up 10 jugs of water and dump them into the garbage. Bishlam Shmuel, according to Shmuel's explanation, Shumachi Yotzi Vitain Ktuba. For that reason, it's grounds for divorce and she gets her Ktuba because he's asking her to do something that is not proper and is not tenable for a woman to live in a situation where she always has to run around afterwards and she's trying to prevent becoming pregnant. Those are things that are not acceptable. Elo lematnita, according to the Braita, my nafka lamina. What's the difference to her? Tiavid, let her do it. Let her fill up the water, dump it into the garbage. What's the big deal? Sam Rabba Barchana, Rabbi Yochanan, mipnei shenireit kishota. She looks like a fool. She looks like someone who is out of her mind. Again, we don't force her into positions or predicaments in which she's going to be embarrassed or people are going to think of her as a social outcast. She does not have to conduct herself in that manner in order to satisfy her husband. Amar Rav Kahana, המדיר את אשתו שלא תישאל ושלא תשאיל נפה וכברה וריחיים ותנור. If he takes a nether that his wife will not lend out and not borrow a winnow, sieve, a mill, an oven. Obviously, this is a movable oven. So in these cases, if he says that you may not do any of these items, or you may not lend out any of these items, or borrow any of these items, yotzi v'ten ktuba. That's again grounds for a divorce, and she gets her ktuba. She misia shem ra b'shchenuta. Because it gives her a bad name amongst her neighbors. It ruins her reputation. It makes her seem like someone who is miserly, someone who does not interact in the normal manner that neighbors would interact. And because, again, he doesn't have the right to put her in predicaments, which will make her into a hermit or into a social outcast. So again, here, this is grounds for divorce and the right to her ktuba. So in these cases, I would say that we spoke about this yesterday a little bit, that you have to take the Gemara in the social context in which it's found. The Gemara and the Torah itself are very advanced in terms of women's rights and protection of women's rights in the social context in which they're found. And obviously, in today's terms, they would not be considered women's rights. But in the day and in the social context in which the Gemara is written, it's clear that the Mishnayot and the Gemara here are providing for protections of women that were not found in other situations. Here where the woman, if she's mistreated, has rights to divorce, has rights to her ketubah. Again, if he makes her or puts her into a position where she is a social outcast, all of these cases are grounds for divorce. Again, these were practices that seemingly were not uncommon, and yet here the Gemara affords her these protections. So the same thing, whenever we have any of these issues, it's issues where there's no reasonable reason why he would do this. It's just similarly punitive or quote-unquote protective of the woman. In those cases, the Gemara or the Mishnah says that she has a right to divorce. If there's a reasonable or logical reason why he would do this, like we saw before by the wedding, then we would obviously look into the matter and say if it's a reasonable request or a reasonable nether that he's taking, then that's not grounds for divorce. That's a good question. In terms of physical abuse, the Gemara of the Mishnah doesn't address it directly, although there is an Iser d'oraita of Chovel b'chaveiro, which would be applicable not just in the context of marriage, in any situation, which you're not allowed to injure another person. Here the Gemara is dealing with more of an emotional type of abuse, which again is much more advanced conceptually, that they even considered that to be problematic and allowed grounds for divorce in those issues. So Gemara says, Tanya Nami Ochi, we have a braita that supports that understanding. Now, he, shinadra, shalot tishael, velo tashil, nafa, ukvara, rechaim, etanur, vishalot harog, bigadim, naim, levanav. If she takes such a nether, that she will not interact with the neighbors in this manner, she won't lend out, she won't borrow, and she will not weave clothing or nice clothing for the children, teitzei, shalot biktuba, she will lose her ktuba in that case, she'll be divorced and lose her ktuba, pineshima, siato, shem, ravishchenav. Just like if he causes her a bad name or ruins her reputation with the neighbors, so too, the same by her. If she ruins his reputation by the neighbors and does not conduct herself in a normal manner, that's also grounds for divorce. And again, from the husband's side, it's grounds for divorce where she will lose her ketubah because of this type of activity. Now, the next Mishnah has another list of items which are grounds for divorce. But here, they're grounds for divorce where the woman's going to lose the ketubah because of her behavior. These are women who are divorced and lose their ktubah. Someone who violates dat Moshe is clearly something that is mina Torah, written in the Torah. Dat Yehudit is somewhat more amorphous. It seemingly is something that is not explicit in the Torah. Whether it's just a minhag, it's just a practice of the Bnot Yisrael, or is it dat yudit means that it's something that part of the oral tradition, which might even be Torah she'be'al peh, that's not so clear from the Mishnah. Now, vezi dat Moshe, what is something that's a violation of the Torah rules, grounds for divorce without a ktubah? Machilato she'ne me'usar. She feeds him food that doesn't have masrot, trumot or masrot removed from it. Umisham shato nida. She has relations with him while she is a nida. Velo kotala chala. She does not separate out chala from the dough or the bread that she bakes. Vinoderet ve'ena mikayemet. She takes nidarim and does not keep, does not abide by the nidarim that she has taken. So all of these are grounds for divorce, but divorce without a ketubah, because she's violating Yisurim Doraita. The Gemara will discuss each of these issues. I just make a small comment here as to the fact that it's not every Yisur Doraita that is grounds for divorce without a ketubah. Just because she violates a Torah law is not a grounds to lose her ketubah. Here there are specific things that relate to their relationship or the ability to maintain a relationship between them. If she's going to provide food and she's going to be the Akeret Habayit, then in that situation, if she is doing things improperly and intentionally doing them improperly, that is grounds for divorce without a ketubah. She's ruining their ability to live together. Just because she violates Nisu Doraita, that's not grounds for her to lose her ketubah. Vezui dat yudit. What is considered to be dat yudit over here? Yotza v'rosha parua. She goes out and her hair is uncovered. Vitova b'shuk. And she weaves stitches in the public arena. Again, the Gemara will go through each of these items. Umidaberet im kol adam. She is very gregarious and seems to interact with everyone. Again, the Gemara will talk about what the issue is. Abashalomer afa mikelelet yoldav bifanav. Even if she curses those that gave birth to him, bifanav, in front of him. She curses his parents in front of him. Rabbi Tarfon omer afa kolanit. Even a woman who has a very loud voice. Vezi kolanit. What does it mean, a loud voice? She midaberet bitoch beita. When she speaks in the house, ushchena shomim kola. And the neighbors can hear what she says. Again, the Gemara will go through each of these issues. It's not simply because she's loud. It has to do with the nature of what she's loud about. Right now, the Gemara says, machiloto shenu mi'usar. She feeds them things that do not have maser taken off of them. Hechi dami. What exactly is the case here? Idiyada. If he knows she's doing it, nifrosh. Then he shouldn't be partaking of the food. He shouldn't violate the Isser if he knows that she's not taking off Masrot. He have to take it off himself. It still might be, we'll see in a second whether that's grounds for divorce or not, but still, he shouldn't be in violation. He's not violating the Isser. Idolo yodo, if he doesn't know, mino yodo, then how does he know? If he doesn't know that she's not taking it off, then how does he know? And then how does he know to divorce her without a ketubah? Because he has no idea this is going on. Lotzricha da amrale, because she declares to him, Ploni Kohen Tikein Li Etakri. So and so the Kohen took care of this and took off the Trumot to Masrot. Vazil Shaile. He goes and checks with the Kohen. Vishtakach Shikra. And he finds out that she lied. Now from our Gemara over here, many of the Rishonim conclude, number one, that the only time that this is grounds for divorce without ketubah is if he actually eats the Isur. If she does it in a way where he eats the Isur, then it's grounds for divorce. If it's just, he catches it beforehand, then it's not maybe necessarily a grounds for divorce without ketubah, as Tosafot says over here, because she can just say, I was playing with you, and I would have told you before you came to eat it. I was just seeing if you would catch it. I mean, that she can come up with excuses for why she did this, or the fact that it wasn't really an intent to cause him to be over the Isur. So over here, from our Gemara, it sounds like you have to actually violate the Isur, which is that he eats the Isur, then that's the grounds for divorce without ketubah. Yushalmi is more ambiguous, and there it sounds like the fact that she was willing to do this and she's caught in the act might be enough to suggest that it's a violation. That's number one. Number two is, with regards to the Isur that is associated over here, that Isur is from her perspective, which is that she's feeding him Isur that he would otherwise not eat. Based on that, the Kobetz Shiurim says that if he's a guy who eats not kosher, he's a guy that doesn't eat musar any of the time, he can't call that grounds for divorce that she is not taking care of him. It has to be that his practice is to do this, which would be the act properly halachically, and then she does it wrong. If he acts improperly halachically, he can't demand of his wife that she act in a manner that is halachically proper, otherwise she'll lose her ketubah. Meaning that the Isur has to be where he wouldn't have violated the Isur without her. If he violates the Isur anyway, then there's not grounds for divorce. So if he eats non-kosher and she feeds him non-kosher food, that's not grounds for divorce without a ketubah, because he would have eaten non-kosher even without her participation here. Umisham shto nida, case where she has intimate relations while she's in nida, hey chidami, what's the case? Idi yodo ba, if he knows about it, nifrosh, he shouldn't have relations with her and then he won't be in violation of the Isur. Idi lo yodo, if he doesn't know about it, nismach ilava, then he should rely on her. She has nemanut when it comes to nida. Dam Rabbi Chinen Abar Kana Mashmo Minayin Lidida Nida Shesofer Leatzma. How do we know that nida counts for herself, meaning her yemei tahara, that she counts for herself, and she is believed with regards to whether she is tmeya or tehora? Shenemar, because the pasuk says v'safra la shivat yamim, that she counts the 7 days. La leatzma. La means that she herself does the counting. So if that's the case, she has nemanut here by Nida. Tosavot in other places in Shas quotes it as the source for the fact that, quote-unquote, Eidechan is neman bisurim, or the fact that a woman is believed with regards to kashrut, with regards to masrot, with regards to Nida. This is the source for the fact that the woman is believed in instances where she's in control of the situation, and she can make the halachic determination. She is believed in that case. So does Safra Lo over here. What's interesting about this is that, since we're in the middle of Sfirat Omer now, the Gemara makes a distinction between Sfirat Omer, where it says, Usfartim Lachem, Sfirat Lachol Echad Ve'Echad, versus by Beit Din, where it says, V'Safarta Lecha, where it's written in the singular form, by Yovel, where it's the Beit Din's obligation. So the Gemara makes a distinction between singular and plural. When it's written in plural, it's every individual's obligation. Where it's written in the singular, then it's the obligation of Klal Yisrael as a whole, or the Beit Din's obligation. Over here, it's written in the singular, and yet it's her personal obligation. That might be for two reasons. One is it uses the word la here and not sfarta lecha, which would normally in the lashon. The other reason is that Beit Din can't know. This is something that she could only know. She's the only one who really can know the count of Tuma and Tahara. It's very hard to get outside verification and to do the counting. Tosafot also raises another issue over here. Why doesn't she make a bracha on the sfira? Just like we make a bracha on Sfirat Omer, and we make a bracha on Sfirat Yovel, why don't we make a bracha here on the Sfirat HaYamim for a Nida? When Safra La Shivat Yamim, she counts the 7 days, why shouldn't she make a bracha on it? So Tosafot says, because it's out of her control. It's something that could be Nistar. What happens if she counts 4 days and she has a sighting? She has to restount the 7 day count. So how can you make a bracha on the count if you're not sure that you're going to complete the count of 7 days? And therefore, you don't make a bracha in this instance because it's not something that you are in control of. That's one way to express it. But it might be like the argument that you have by Sfirat Omer that the counting of each day is a mitzvah. If you do say that, then possibly over here she should make a bracha. But over here again, she's not doing anything active. The Sfira is just a check that something has not happened. And therefore, maybe over there, it's not called the Sfira in the sense of she has to make an enumeration, day one, day two. Therefore, you can't make a bracha on it. What's interesting is that the Mishnah Berurah brings down with regards to women making a bracha by Sfirat HaOmer, that when it comes to Sfirat HaOmer, the minhag is that women or Ashkenazi women do make a bracha on mitzvah taseisha zman grama when they do it voluntarily. Yet the Mishnah Berurah says that they shouldn't make a bracha because karol the vadai, that'll be a bracha the vatala because they won't get through the whole Sfira. It's unlikely that they'd be able to finish the whole Sfira. It's a similar type of idea over here, just like over here where we have a belief by the Nida that it's possible she won't finish off the Sfira, so she shouldn't make a bracha. So it's over there, the Mishnah Berurah, in a sense, invokes the same concept, which is that if she's not going to finish the Sfira, she shouldn't make a bracha. You're correct. It's not exactly the same reason, which is by Nida, it's so tear the count, and then she has to restart the count. By Sfirat HaOmer, it might be one big mitzvah, and therefore the absence of one day might preclude you from counting the whole time. Yeah, they're not identical, but the concept being that we don't enter into a situation of making brachot, we're uncertain of the outcome, or we think the outcome is not going to be guaranteed. Even in the modern day, where women are counting and are able to maintain the counts and do much more finishing up the sfira, the fact that a man attends Ma'ariv and goes to Minyan every night is almost a guarantee that they will count the Omer, versus a woman who's doing it independently. For probabilities, if someone knows within themselves that there's a high likelihood that they won't finish the sphira, they're unable to finish the sphira, maybe they should count without a bracha. Yeah, that's saying that we're choshesh for the day that says it's one big mitzvah. If every day is a separate mitzvah, then you can make a bracha anyway. Suffik bracha does a hakel. So whenever you have a suffik like that, we're not going to make a bracha. But if you have a likelihood that you're going to finish it, then you take that risk. Maybe we do the same thing by fast days. We don't say anenu. Rashi says over there that we don't say anenu until mincha, even though the Baal HaMor brings down. Rashi himself actually brings from the Gaonim, say anenu at every tefillah during a fast day. Yet Rashi says our practice is not to do that. We only say anenu by mincha, because by mincha time already, there's a pretty good likelihood that you're going to finish the fast day, and therefore we're willing to take the risk of saying anenu there and not look like you're lying in tefillah, that you're saying we're fasting. But earlier on in the day, there's no guarantee that you're going to finish the fast. So we don't want to take that risk of lying inside of tefillah. So again, that concept. Now, it could be that you should say anenu because it's a yom tanit, not because you're fasting. But the way that Rashi reads it is anenu is related to the fact that biyom tzom tanitenu, that we're fasting. And you don't want to lie in tefillah. Because when you stand before God, you don't want to be a liar. So therefore, we only say it at mincha time. The same concept that these ideas that we want to be close to certain that you can finish. It's not an absolute. It's not 100%. But if you get it high enough probability that you can actually finish, then we will allow you to make a brach or make statements. All right. Lo tzricha d'amrle ploni chacham tiar li et adam. That's a case where she says that so-and-so told me that the dam was tahor and that I'm okay. Vazo shayli. And then he goes, the husband goes and checks with the chacham. Vishtakach shikra. And he finds out that she was lying about the fact that it was tahor. V by dema. If you want to suggest this is another possibility, kidrav yudah. If a woman is known to be a nidah to her neighbors, and again, in their day, it seems that it was a well-known fact, if a woman was a nidah, that all her neighbors knew, either because of the clothing that she wore, she had specific clothing that she wore when she was a nidah, or because of the staining, or the fact that she might have actually moved to a separate living quarters or separate house because of the tumah of the nidah. So it's something that was well known amongst the neighbors. Bala loke aleha mishum nida. If her husband has intimate relations with her, then he'll get malkot for being together with a nida. I mean, that's enough of a establishment of a fact that she's a nida. If her neighbors know that she's a nida, that establishes the fact that she is a nida. So similarly over here, in a case where he has intimate relations with her, not knowing that she's a nida, and then the neighbors say that she was clearly a nida, that she acted and she had clothing on that had stains on it and so on and so forth, all these things that seem to indicate that she was a nida amongst her shechinim, that's also a reason after the fact where you can make a determination that she was lying. The way Rashi fits it over here is that the clothing that she had a stain on it, a dam stain on it. She goes, don't worry about it, it was something else, it wasn't a nida. Then afterwards they hear from the neighbors that she was wearing it, and if she was a nida, that would be again a case where he finds out after the fact that she was lying about the information. Hello, kotzala chala. She doesn't separate off chala. Hechidami, what's the case here? Idi yado, again, if he knows about it, nifrosh, he should just not partake of the bread. Idi lo yado, if he doesn't know, mina yado, then how does he know anymore? Lo, tzricha da amrale ploni gaval tikein li et ha'isa. The baker took care of this and took off the chala. Vazo shayli, and he goes and checks with the baker. Vishtakach shikra, and she finds out that he was lying. So gaval is someone who needs the kneader of the dough. Likelihood here is the baker, and she claims that the baker took off the challah, and he finds out that that was not the case. V'noderet ve'ena mikayemet. She takes nidarim and does not keep the nidarim. Damar mar bavon nidarim banim meitim. For the sin of nidarim, children die. It means the sin of not keeping nidarim, that is punishable through the loss of children. Now Tosafot mentioned daf ago, when it comes to nidarim of inoy nefesh, over there, even if she's mikayemet them, that's grounds for divorce without a tuba, because he calls her an isha nadranit. I don't want a woman who takes lots of vows. There's just too much risk in that. There, if it's an inui nefesh, he can divorce her even if she is mikayem the nidarim. Over here, where we're talking about ena mikayemet, those are regular nidarim. And since she doesn't keep the nidarim, he's risked to his children for this. How do we know this? Shenemar, it says in Kohelet, Al titain et picha lachti et bisarecha. Don't let your mouth cause problems for your flesh. Now, the Gemara here doesn't quote the remainder of the pasuk, but the end of the next pasuk over there says, v'chibel et ma'asei yadecha. And then you will destroy the works of your hands. Ezuin ma'asei yadav shel adam. What are the works of the hands of an individual? Havi omer banav umnotav. The children of the individual are the work of his hand. So what's going to happen? Al titen et picha, from your mouth is going to cause the problem that your children or your masi yadayim will be destroyed. How was that? You take nidarim and you don't keep them. From Nachman Amar Mihocha, Nachman says it's from Yirmiyahu Bet, which is l'shav hikite et b'neichem. The Navi is saying it in a rhetorical way, which is, you think I killed your children for naught? I'm going to wipe out your children for naught? And then he explains why he's going to kill them. But the Gemara reads it as this, l'shav hikite et b'neichem, l'shav aliske shav. What does it mean, shav? Because of things that have to do with shav. You do things that are in violation of nidarim or shvuot that you took. So that you took them in vain because you didn't keep them. So that's what it means. Lashav, over issues of in vain, meaning not keeping your nedarim and shvot, hikeiti epinechem. I destroyed your children. So over there, the Gemara is reading it as a statement rather than a rhetorical question that it is in the Navi itself. Tanya, Rabbi Meir Omer, kol yodea bishtoshinol deret, ve'ena mikayemet. If a person knows that his wife takes nedarim and doesn't keep them, yachzor v'yadirena. He should take nedarim for her, should be, put her into a box with nedarim. Where it says, yadirena, if he takes the nedarim, am I mitakin la? How does he solve the problem? She's just going to violate whatever he says too. If she's violating her nedarim, he's going to violate his nedarim. That doesn't solve the problem. Ela yachzor v'yiknitena. He should provoke her, k'day shetidor b'fanav, so that she takes all her nedarim in front of him, v'yaferla, and then he can nullify it. So Rabbi Meir suggests that the solution to the problem is that he should nullify the nedarim. Now, he can nullify the nedarim whenever he finds out about them. So why does he want to have her take the nedarim right in front of him? Because in the instance where she takes it in front of him and he nullifies it right away, there's never a violation of the neder. On the other hand, if she takes the nether and then he not finds about it later and nullifies it, we said before the difference between hafarat nedarim and petach the nether is that when the chacham is matir the nether, that's retroactively, it undermines the nether. Hafarat is a prospective nullification of the nether. That means she's held accountable for the nether from the time that she took it until the nullification of the husband. So therefore, he doesn't want her taking the nedarim and then he finds out about it later and nullifies it because in the interim, she's violating the nedar and that's going to cause problems for his children. So what does he do? He provokes her to take the nedarim in front of him so he can nullify them right away. Amrulo, they said to Rabbi Meir, Ein adam darim nachash b'kfifa. Person doesn't live with a snake inside of the same basket. So even though the snake is all charmed down and he's all okay, you don't live next to the snake because you don't take risks. If something could go wrong at any moment. What happens if he doesn't catch it? What happens if he's not there? It's just too risky for an individual to be in bed with such a situation. So therefore, we say he can get divorced without granting her a ketubah, because we're not going to make him work with her in this way, where he's trying to always nullify her nidarim. Tanya, Ayah Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ko yodea bishto she'ena kotzo lo chala. So this goes back to what we said before. If he knows that his wife's not taking off challah, yachzor v'yafrish achara. Let him just separate out the challah, and then they'll solve the problem. Amrlo, ein adam dar im nachash b'kfifa. Again, they answer Rabbi Yehuda and say, that's a nice solution, but it's not necessarily tenable. Because a person doesn't want to live in that type of risky situation where if he forgets or he thinks that his wife's taken off, and he knows, oh, I forgot that she doesn't take challah, I got to take off challah now. So we don't want to put a person in that situation. Certainly in the other case. So that Rabbi Huda, who says that by the case of chala, that he can deal with it, then certainly he can deal with it in the case of nidarim. So Rabbi Huda would definitely agree with Rabbi Meir's position. If Rabbi Huda says he can deal with it with regards to chala, then he can deal with it in terms of nidarim. Rabbi Meir, who says by nidarim you can deal with it, avalha, by the case of mafrish chala, zimna de mikri v'achil. Sometimes it'll just happen, he'll eat it and he'll forget about it. The difference being what Rashi says is shchiach and lo shchiach. Is it something that happens on a frequent basis or it's infrequent? With regards to being mafrish chala, that's a daily activity. Something that happens all the time, he's eating chala, he's eating bread all the time. So there, if you say by there that he can handle the situation, be mafrish himself, then certainly by nidarim, which are less frequent or more infrequent, then you can agree that he'll take care of the situation. Now then, according to Rabbi Meir, who says that he can deal with it with regards to nidarim, that's because it happens once in a while. But to have to deal with it on a daily basis, that's way too much. And again, zimne mikre v'achil, it'll happen that he'll come around and end up eating it, and we don't want that to transpire over here. Right, so many of the Rishonim discuss over here with regards to the Mishnah, is this an obligation to get divorced or does he have the right to divorce her? Is it a mitzvah to divorce such a woman? That's the position of the Rosh and many others, that a woman who acts in this manner, it's a mitzvah to divorce her because in Adam Darim Nachash B'Kfifa, exactly for that reasoning, that a man doesn't live together with a snake in a basket. It's too risky to be in such a relationship. Therefore, it's a mitzvah to divorce her. Other Rishonim believe that it's a right of divorce, meaning that if he so chooses to divorce her, she loses her ketubah in this case. Even if he doesn't divorce her immediately, this has abdicated her right to the ketubah, and therefore if the husband chooses to divorce her, then he has a right to divorce without a ketubah. If he doesn't choose to divorce her, he can live with this problem. But that's not a mitzvah, but a right to divorce her without a ketubah. Havezi dat Yehudit, what is called dat Yehudit? Yotza v'roshah perua. The case where she goes out and her head is uncovered. Rosha parua deoraitoi. Wait, going out with the uncovered hair, that's an iser deoraita dichtiv, because it says in the pasuk parat rosha isha. By the case of sota, it says that he will remove the covering of the head. Really, here it means to unbraid, to let loose her hair. And as Rashi says over here, it brings two interpretations. One is that's midah keneged midah, because she did or she undid her hair for the extramarital affair. Therefore, we do the same thing to her over here, which means normally her hair was covered. Midah keneged midah, we are minavla. We do something that denigrates her or embarrasses her in public. She did it in private for the boel. Therefore, we do it in public to demonstrate the fact that she acted inappropriately. That's one way to read it. Rashi brings a second reason, which he likes better, which is that the fact that the kohen uncovers her hair means that until that point it was covered, or that it was somehow not revealed, and now he's revealing the hair of the woman, which means in a regular situation, it would have not have been revealed, and that's what he says, Ein derech benot Yisrael etzeit pruot rosh. It's not normal for the young women of Israel to go out with their hair uncovered, because that's why by the sota, he's uncovering her hair, implying that otherwise it would have been covered. So now if that's a din d'oraita, then why are we talking about dat Yehudit and not dat Moshe? So again, that could be the differentiation between minog versus d'oraita, or the practice versus d'oraita, or it could be that one is Torah Shebichtav, here it's a derivative of Torah Shebichtav, versus something that's a derivative of Torah Shebalpeh. V'tana debay Rabbi Shmuel, azara lebnot Yisrael shelo yitzu b'pru arosh. So that's a warning. That is an isur min haTorah, that they should not go out with their hair uncovered. So Gemara says, deoraita min haTorah, then a kilta shapir dami. Then a work basket is sufficient. That's the way that some of the Rishonim translate it. It's like what Rashi seems to translate it. The Orach, on the other hand, talks about a kippah on her head, that a small covering would suffice, either a covering like a kippah or a work basket, like the Arab women that walk around that have a basket on their head that they can carry things on the top of it. That's sufficient coverage in terms of deoraita. Dat Yehudit, afilo kilta nami asur. According to the Dat Yehudit, that's not sufficient for her to go out. Am Rabbi Yasi, Am Rabbi Yochanan, kilta ein ba mishum pru arosh. If a woman has got this basket or this kippah on her head, she doesn't have a din of pru arosh. Hafi ba Rabbi Zeira hecha. So Rabbi Zeira asks, where is that the case? What's the chiddush here of Rabbi Yochanan that we don't already know? So ilema bashuk. If you go out in the shuk, dat Yehuditi. You can't go out like that because there's dat Yehudit that says she has to have her entire head covered. Velo b'chatzer, if it's in her private domain, meaning in her own chatzer, imkein lo anachta bat amar v'vino, she yoshevet tach balad. That's untenable for a woman to always have her hair covered, even in her private home, even in her chatzer. She yoshevet tach balad. Nobody's going to want to remain married because then she'll have to have her hair covered, even in her chatzer. Amar Abayi v'itema Rav Kahana, mi'chatzer l'chatzer v'derech mavui. If she goes from courtyard to courtyard and she passes through the mavui, which is the alleyway or a quasi-public domain in between. So what you have here are three different locations. The Rambam himself in formulating the halacha quotes the Yushalmi that says that sometimes a chatzer looks like a mavui and sometimes a mavui looks like a chatzer. Which is that it may not be defined by the location itself, but it might be defined by the traffic in the location. Sometimes the private house or the chatzer itself become like a public domain or like a mavoi because the number of people that are there, there are outsiders that are in there. Sometimes there's nobody in the mavoi and therefore it remains a private domain. It remains like a chatzer. But you have three different locations, which is the public domain. In the public domain, she has to cover her hair with a kilta, which is a kippah or a basket. But Dat Yehudit insists that not only that, but she also has to cover her hair entirely, not just sufficient to have her head covered by the basket or by the kippah, just have her entire head covered. Whereas by the case of Mavoi, there she can use this kilta, is sufficient of a covering in that location. And then in the chatzer, where it is her private domain, then she doesn't have to cover her hair at all. Now, the Gemara in Yoma talks about Kimchit, who was zocha to have 7 Kohanim Gedolim that came out of her. And the Gemara asks, why was she zocha? It says, because lo ra'ah korot beita. The beams of her house never saw her hair, that she covered her hair even inside the house. So we see there is this idea a minhag yafa, a midat chasidut, vitzniut, for a woman to cover her hair, even inside of the house, even in areas that are more private. Now, amongst the Rishonim, there's definitely a machloket over here as to what is demanded of the woman. You can see in Tosfot, a perish, a nami, ba mishum priat rosh. In her chatzer, she doesn't have to cover her hair whatsoever. I mean that she can have her hair down and out, and there's no issue at all. Now, whether the covering of the hair, d'oraita, extends to what level, that is subject to machloket Rishonim, and also deals with gemarot that come in other places. There's a gemar in Brachot that says, ser b'isha erva, that the hair of a woman is an erva. Over there, the gemara talks about the area of a tefach, that a tefach has to be exposed in order for it to be problematic. The gemara there also qualifies the situation that it's talking about kriyat shema and ishto and his own wife. Therefore, many of the Rishonim imply from that, that if it's not his wife, and forgetting about kriyat shema, that it's an erva even less than a tefach would be problematic. Any exposure of the hair would be problematic. And then that joined together with our Gemara would insist that when a woman's in a public domain or a place that is public, that she has to cover all of her hair, that she can't leave anything exposed. If you want to say, according to some of the Rishonim, that tefach bisha erva is still applicable here by seyar, that means only if a tefach of the seyar is exposed, then there's a problem, even by other women, not just by his wife. Then Rav Moshe Feinstein in the Igud Moshe points out that that's a tefach squared, meaning that you can't leave out a tefach where a lot of women leave the front of their hair, their bangs out, or the back of their hair out, which is a tefach. That's not the case. You have to look at a tefach squared. So that means that if you're looking at a tefach squared, you'd have to use like two fingers across the whole front. That's already a tefach. Because if you readjust it, that would be an exposure of a tefach. So it's much less than you think. Even if you think that there's a tefach exposure, it's not a fist worth of exposure, because that's not the square area is much bigger than that. And so you have to look at the whole area that's exposed. And therefore, according to Rav Moshe, if you think that you can expose the tefach, it's a very small amount of hair that can be exposed in that case. The Rishonim, the Mordechai, and the Meiri and others over there talk about the little hairs or strands of hairs that come out of the hair covering. Those are not problematic. Those are not considered to be erva because her hair is covered. And many of the Rishonim talk about, in all these cases of erva, things that are normally covered. Things that are normally covered should not be exposed. Therefore, the Aruch HaShulchan has a huge chiddush. Many people misquote the chiddush of the Aruch HaShulchan, but he says, in our day and age, where women don't cover their hair, it's no longer classified as an erva. Now, what he doesn't say is that women don't have to cover their hair, and it's not classified as an erva. What he says is it's not classified for an erva l'gabei kriyat shema. Since women expose their hair or leave their hair uncovered all the time, then vis-a-vis kriyat shema, then it won't be classified as an erva because it's not a makom that is normally covered anymore. It's a place that is normally left open. Now, you can ask the question against the Aruch HaShulchan, which is, nobody would suggest that if a woman came with her thighs exposed, that it's not an erva because women walk around with their thighs exposed today. Nobody would say you could say kriyat shema over there. So the answer there might be because when you're talking about erva like shok, or the erva of the zroa of the arms, there you're talking that inherent erva. That's erva, which is areas that are restricted no matter what. Those are areas of the woman that should be covered and have to be covered. And if they're exposed, it's inherent erva and it's problematic. With regards to the seyar of the isha, the hair itself is not an inherent erva. It's an erva because the Torah tells us that the women covered their hair and then they're going to expose that hair. So it takes on a status of erva because of the fact that the women cover their hair. Therefore, maybe the Aruch HaShulchan says you can have a leniency by the hair when it's uncovered all the time, then it doesn't take on that status of erva vis-a-vis kriyat shema.
Is it cultural, but
the Aruch HaShulchan is misquoted and says that covering hair has to do with social norms. That's not what the Aruch HaShulchan says. The Aruch HaShulchan says that the women are obligated to cover their hair, and it's an erva. The only thing he says is, with regards to the din of kriyat shema, over there, by kriyat shema, a person should not be in front of an erva. But many of the Rishonim quote over there that places that are normally covered, that are exposed, are problematic. And he says, by hair, maybe today, because the women walk around with their hair uncovered all the time, it won't be deemed an erva for kriyat shema. Not that you have permission not to cover your hair. There are certain things with regards to arayot, which are correct, that have to do with social norms, which is that there are things that are inherent erva, like shok, which is an erva no matter what. There are other things like the covering of the feet or wearing of socks, which has to do with the social norms. The Shulchan Aruch already, the Beit Yosef quotes the fact that the women in their areas go around walking around barefoot or with their ankles exposed. So he says it's not an erva because that's the practice of the women in this place. Now obviously they were wearing tunics all the way down to their ankles. It wasn't like their whole leg was exposed, but they didn't wear socks. So he said therefore it's not considered to be an erva anymore. But you have to know that there are certain areas that are inherent erva, which there's no issue of whether the social norms are or not. There are other areas where, yes, the social norms will govern whether one has to cover those areas. And that might be the difference between Dat Torah and Dat Yehudit. Dat Torah might be those areas that are inherently erva, whereas the other things of Dat Yehudit might be those with the extension of that. And that, according to some of the Rishonim, therefore, the Midoraita, the only requirement of covering the hair is a kippah or a kilta. More than that is not necessary min haTorah. Now, Dat Yehudit demands that. But then that, what's Dat Yehudit? It comes, what's the social norms? Maybe those things impact over here. Others suggest, no, that right across the board, a woman has to have her hair entirely covered in Rishit HaBavim based on the fact that the Gemara in Brachot talks about, says, Sarah B'Isha is an erva. And that doesn't have limitation of kiltar. That means any amount of the hair is considered to be an erva. You also have the Mishnah in Shabbat that talks about a woman wearing on Shabbat a kabul or a peah nachrit, which is wearing a wig. And the Gemara wants to know over there, where is she allowed to wear that on Shabbat? We're afraid of her wearing in her Rishit HaBavim. There the Gemara says that she should wear in the chatzer, she lo titkaneh al ba'ala. She should wear in the chatzer so she doesn't become disgusting and menuval to her husband. But that indicates that she's wearing some sort of hair covering, even in the chatzer. So against what our Gemara is saying here, where it's seemingly, according to Tosafot, in the chatzer she doesn't have to wear anything, that Gemara in Shabbat seems to indicate she's wearing something on her head inside of the chatzer. Now you could argue there the chatzer is more like a public chatzer, and therefore it's more like a mavoi than a chatzer. Or you could argue that what Tosafot says over here is incorrect. In a chatzer she still has to cover her hair, she just can expose more of the hair in the chatzer. In the mavoi she has to cover more, and then Rishut HaRabim she has to cover even more, but never that she can go with her hair exposed. And you can see this difference of opinions in the Ritva and the Rashba on the sugya over here. I sent out the Mekorot, but two things to note is that all the Mefarshim write that the minhag of the Betulot was not to cover their hair, that young women did not cover their hair, and therefore the practice that only married women cover their hair, and not Betulot, and not young women do not cover their hair. Rav Avad Yosef has a tshuva about that, saying that that's only with regards to the fact that Erva, but with regards to making a bracha, or having one's head covered when they are in shul, that women have to have their hair covered, even if they're not married. They have to have their hair covered inside of shul, not because of erva, but because of, like, kippah, like a man, that you have to have your head covered. So a woman who covers her hair, then she already has something over her head. But a young woman who is, min adin, not required to cover her hair, or the betulot are not required to cover their hair, then in that instance, women would have to cover their hair because of brachot or because of shul, not because of erva. There are opinions that say that even by bitulot, that they have to cover their hair. It might be there that they have to cover less of their hair. And that comes to the Hasidish practice where young girls braid their hair when they are below the age of marriage. And that is because here it says, Ufara Rosh Aisha, is to let it out, to let the braids out. So then they have the practice by the younger girls that they braid the hair so that it's not Ufara Rosh Aisha in public, even though it's not a full covering. They agree that once you get married, you do cover the hair fully, but before that point in time, they braid the hair. Moshe also has an important tshuva that with regards to the practice of hair covering, it's up to the woman. That if they did not stipulate before they got married the way that the woman will cover her hair, then when it comes to the marriage, then the woman gets to determine if she wears a wig or if she literally covers her hair. Rav Moshe has a tshuva from a young bochur who's asking whether he can compel his wife to cover her hair and not use a peah nachrit, not use a wig. And Rav Moshe says, it's not your choice, it's up to your wife. You didn't stipulate this before the marriage, and therefore it's her mitzvah, she can do the mitzvah the way that she feels is correct. And there are plenty of dayot that support the fact that a woman can wear a wig, and therefore if she chooses to wear a wig, you cannot object to that. Now for Sfaradim, that might be different, because Rav Avad Yosef says that a wig is not considered to be a hair covering, and it's problematic, and therefore the Sfaradim that follow Rav Avad Yosef have to cover their hair, not through using a peah nachrit, actually you have to use a tichel or some sort of physical covering of the hair, and not a peah nachrit, although it's interesting enough that this is one of the areas, despite the tremendous power of Rav Avad Yosef, this is one of the areas where the Sfaradi women, still many of them wear wigs, despite the fact that Rav Ben Yosef says that it's not a proper hair covering. All right. The tova b'shuk, she weaves out in the shuk. Amar Rav Yehuda Meshmol, b'mara zrotel b'nei adam. She exposes her arms by doing this in the shuk. She rolls up her sleeves to do the work, and therefore she's exposing her arms, and that's a problem of erva. V'chista amar Rav Yimei, b'tava vered k'neged paneah. The case where she is weaving, the word vered over here can have a number of interpretations. One is rose, the color rose or red. K'neged paneah can either mean her face, or it can be a euphemism for her face below. So hey, Rashi reads it as vered is actually from the word like radeid or yored, goes down. That she is weaving, and she drops down the weave towards her private parts down below, and therefore draws attention to that area. So that's one possibility. The Rabbeinu Chanano, which Tosafot quotes over here, says that she uses the red color, k'neged paneah, near her face, because that causes her face to be radiant. And therefore, it's again, it's an idea that it's not sanua or not sniut for her to conduct herself in this way, because it brings attention to her. The Rambam even says if she wears something that's red on her face, not that she's weaving to get the reflection, but she wears red on her face, around her face, like a flower of some sort, that is problematic. So whatever the issue is in this secondary clause, it's a problem of itzniut, a lack of tzniut here, but she's drawing attention to herself, which would be improper. Umidaberet im kol adam, she speaks to any individual. Amar Yehuda Amar Shmuel, b'smisacheket im bachurim. She flirts with the young men, which again is an improper type of behavior. It's a lack of tzniut, lack of good judgment in these areas. And obviously we're worried about the fact that if she's flirting with them, that it's going to lead to something untoward, and therefore it's grounds to divorce without tuba, because it's improper behavior. Amar Rav Rechana, zimna chara avaka izilna batrei de Rav Ukva. There was a time that I was going behind Rav Ukva. Chazite lachai aravya. We saw this Arab woman. Tava yatva. She was sitting. Kashadya pilcha. She was casting her spindle. Vitava vered k'neged paneah. And she was weaving this vered k'neged paneah. Came into chazit tinan. When she saw us, psikte the pilcha, she cut the spindle, shadite, and then threw it out. Amrali, then she said to me, Ulaim, young man, havli pelach, give me back my spindle, can you pass me my spindle? Amar bar Rav Ukva Milta. Rav Ukva said that this woman is an example of something. We don't know what it is. My Amar ba, what did he say about her? Ravina amar tova b'shuk amar ba, this is an example of a woman who's tova b'shuk. And Rabbanan Amre midaberzim kol adam amarba. This is a woman who's flirtatious because she's throwing out the spindle to draw the attention and get the individual to speak to her. Abba Shaul Omer afa mikalelet yoldav bifanav. Even one who curses his parents in front of him. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel be mikalelet yolidav bifnei molidav. Or the way the Groy has the Girsa is yoldav bifnei moldav. That she curses his parents in front of his children. Meaning that the in-laws, she curses in front of their children. Even in that case, it's considered to be problematic. The siman is Ephraim and Menasheh, Reuven and Shimon Yuli. That grandchildren are the same as children. So over here, the Mishnah states the case of where she's cursing the in-laws in front of her husband. The Gemara here adds on that even if it's in front of his children, that's still classified as being as if she's cursing his parents in front of him, and it'd be problematic. Amarabo the Amrale, a case like where she says, Nichle Ariel Saba Bape Bre. She says, the lion should eat up your grandfather in front of the grandchild, in front of the son. So they're talking about the father-in-law, she's speaking about her in-laws, in front of her children, which makes it the grandfather should be eaten by the lion when she's speaking to the children. Again, it's inappropriate type of behavior, disclosure, or speaking about his parents, and therefore it's grounds for divorce without a tuba. Rabbi Tarfon Omer Afa Kolanit, also a woman who is very loud, my Kolanit. It can't be that she's just loud. That's not grounds for divorce. So Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, b'mashmait kolal iskei tashmish. Where she raises her voice on issues of intimacy. So here Rashi explains it's a case where she's discussing issues or matters that are intimate, and she speaks so loudly that all the neighbors can hear her discussing or having this argument with her husband. So she speaks way too loud about issues of intimacy. Others describe it not like Rashi, which is that she's arguing about it, but that she's toveya. She asks for tashmish in such a loud manner that all the neighbors know that she's asking for tashmish, Again, in all these cases, it's inappropriate, it's embarrassing to him, and therefore it's a lack of tzniut. Madita tano, in the bright we have it, mishameshet b'chatzer zu, b'nishma kola b'chatzer acheret. She has tashmish here, and her voice is heard in another chatzer. So now Gemara says, v'nitnei gabi mumim b'matznitin. Why don't you put that in the Mishnah coming up on Ayin Zayin? Why don't you include that in the Mishnah of Mumim? The reason that she's screaming over here is because she's in pain from the Tashmish. So she has so much pain from the Tashmish that she screams out when she's having Tashmish from that pain, and therefore all the neighbors know. Or it's a case where she discloses the fact that she is in pain and she doesn't want to have Tashmish, so all the neighbors know that she doesn't want to have Tashmish over here. So the Gemara says, put that by the mumim, because this is a physical problem that she's unable to bear tashmish, and therefore she screams when she's having tashmish. Gemara says, Ela mechavartek deshina meyikara, you're right. It should have been included in the case of mumim. It doesn't belong in our Mishnah. And therefore the answer we said before is where she raises her voice to the point where she's disclosing information that is otherwise private to the neighbors, especially in issues that are beino leveina, things that are intimate or things that have to do with their relationship. Person has kiddushin with a condition built into it that she doesn't have any nidarim, that there aren't any previous nidarim that are binding on her. And they find out that she did have nidarim, it dissolves the kiddushin because the condition was not fulfilled, and therefore the kiddushin are not kiddushin. Kansastam, if afterwards he consummates the marriage, has nisuin, and then they find out they're nidarim, then she gets divorced without a ktubah. Now, the question of what the relationship of this to the first piece will be the subject of tomorrow's Gemara. Is this a continuation of a case where there was a tznai in the kiddushim and then she had nisuin? Or is this a case that is independent? This is a case totally independent of the first case. So that's not clear from the Mishnah. That'll be a machlok between Rav and Shmuel. Almanat shein ba mumim. He has kiddushim with the condition that she has no physical deformities, no physical issues, and then they find out that she does have them. The kiddushin don't go through, they fail because the condition was not fulfilled. Again, if he has nisuim and consummates the marriage, and then they find these physical issues, these blemishes, she can be divorced without a ktubah. What are the mumim that we're talking about here? What physical problems? The same physical issues that are problems for a Kohen. The list in the Mishnah in Bechorot, which enumerates the physical mumim that apply by a Kohen, they're all applicable by a woman. And therefore, if you want to know which mumim are problematic, you can go look at that list, and those are all considered to be physical mumim that either, well, fail the condition of the Kiddushin, or if she has nisuin, it'll be grounds for divorce without a ktubah. Vitznan, nami gabi kiddushin, gavnings. This Mishnah exactly is found in Masechet Kiddushin. Why does Rebbe, in the Mesadra Mishnah, put an exact same Mishnah in Kiddushin and a Mishnah in Ketubot? Or says, hacha, Ketubot, it's trichale. Our Mishnah here is to tell us about the fact that after Nisuin, she would lose her Ketubah, because we're in Masechet Ketubot. So because of that, Tana Kiddushin, Atu Ketubot. Then as Agav, it brought down the case of Kiddushin, because it was Tana Ketubot. Hotam Kiddushin, it's trichale. Over there, it's talking about the issues of Kiddushin. That's the topic of the Masechta over there. So Tana Ketubot, Tata Kiddushin. It's brought down on Gav. So technically, you would only mention Ketubot over here and Kiddushin over there. But once we're already mentioning them, Rabbi put them together because they are related. And because of that relationship, in both cases, we have the same exact Mishnah. Am Rabbi Yochanan Mishun Rabbi Shimon Ben Yod Sadat. Be'ilu Nidarim Amru. What are examples of Nidarim that would cause problems in the Kiddushin or in the Nisuin? Shelo tuchal basar, shelo tishte yain, she won't eat meat, she won't drink wine, shelo tikashet b'rigdei tzibonim, she won't wear colored clothing. Actually relates to the Gemara yesterday and the Girsu with regards to Rabbi Yossi's opinion about inui nefesh. Afterwards, we had in Rabbi Yossi's opinion, elu inui nefesh. These are considered to be the inui nefesh. We said that the Mishnah in Darim does not say that in the position of Rabbi Yossi, but here you see that the Gemara brings down that these are considered to be inui nefesh. And therefore, these nidarim are unacceptable if he gets married. The Rishonim argue here whether it's only these nidarim, these particular nidarim that are problematic, or are these examples of nidarim. So anything that is inu nefesh or similar to these nidarim would be problematic. Many of the Rishonim seem to indicate that it has to be these types of nidarim, which Rashi says, tabi inu nefesh umit ganei alav. It has both aspects. It's both inu nefesh, which is an affliction of the individual, plus it causes a gnai to her husband. It makes her husband think that she is ugly or disgusting. And therefore, if it only has these two properties, that's why it's a nether. Simple inui nefesh or simple mitgane might not be enough. According to Rashi, you seem to need both of them. And that's why these three issues have both of them embedded in it. And maybe that's why these three nidarim in particular, but not other nidarim. Other rishonim, again, break it down and say, no, maybe it's inui nefesh or mitgane independently, or maybe these are just examples. Tanya nami ochi, we have a bright that supports it. Beilin nidarim amru, dvarim shish ben inui nefesh. These are things that have inui nefesh. Shlo tuchal basar, shlo tishtayayim, shlo titkadesh, big day tzimonim. So over here, you see that it's only inui nefesh that the Braita mentions, maybe not titgane alav that Rashi mentions. Havi baro papa, ahai. What is this going on? Ilaymar reisha, is going on the reisha, kevin the kakopid, afilu kopile nami. So what, if it's going on the reisha, meaning that the case of kiddushin, where he makes a tznai, that there'll be no nidarim, then why does it matter these three? Any nether that bothers him, that fails the condition, and she shouldn't be married. Ella Seifa must be going in the case of Kansastam, in the case where he did not delineate the nidarim, in a case where he took her without saying anything, and he finds out that she has these nidarim, that's grounds for a divorce without a ketubah, because these nidarim are untenable. You can't be in a relationship with these type of nidarim, because it's inui nefesh and mitgane alav. Ravashi Amar the Olam Aresha. No, it's going back on the first part of Kiddushin where he makes the condition. In a case where other people would consider this to be untenable, then for him it's also untenable. In cases where other people would not be makpid on these items, then when he wants to be makpid, it's not a makpid. Now Tosafot over here qualifies and it says that's only when he said stam. But he just said, if she has any nidarim, then the kiddushin failed. If that is the condition of the marriage, then he didn't define what nidarim mean. The definition of nidarim will be then, dat bnei adam. What normal people would consider problematic nidarim. And therefore, this braita and this list of nidarim is talking about that case. These are normal nidarim that people would not consider tenable in a marriage, and it fails. But if you specify the nidarim, other nidarim, then those nidarim, he made a condition, those conditions will stand. So if he enumerates the nidarim and specifies the nidarim, it can be any nidar he wants. But if he doesn't specify, then these are the governing nidarim, this is what people will be makpid on. Although, there is the Ravid who says that even if he specifies the nidarim, bitalei dato etzel kol adam, that we say that whatever he says doesn't matter, because it's governed by what's normal. And since he did something that was abnormal, it wipes away that part of the condition. And the condition is only about nidarim in general. And he can't be makbid on things that normal people are not makbid on. Although most people think like Tosafot. If he says it and he specifies it, then that is a condition of the marriage. Okay, we're going to stop here. Two lines on the bottom. Vayin bet amud bet.